I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, a soldier on the ground in Iraq and an Iraqi stranded in the U.S. But first, the drumbeat of bad economic news continues. The Labor Department announced today that 378,000 Americans applied for jobless benefits last week. That's the highest level in nearly 2 months and a bigger jump than expected. Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank, chair of the House Financial Services Committee, has been a fierce advocate of more government regulation to stem this tide of bad economic news.
Sensible regulation is pro-market because it can instill a degree of confidence in the people who've got the money and are sitting on it that we might not otherwise be able to get.
Congressman Frank outlined his thoughts before Boston business leaders this morning. Here Now's business reporter Kurt Nickisch was there. Kurt, we know that Frank spoke specifically about the credit crunch caused by home lending. What did he say?
We said all these investment banks, you know, these Wall Street firms ended up bundling mortgages and selling the risk and sort of spreading it around to the point that nobody really understood who owned exactly what. And then that house of cards basically came tumbling down. You know, if I lend you $20, I know where you are. I can come and get it back. But these banks sort of lost track of things and these instruments were just way too complicated, Frank says.
Know your borrower. That's the key to successful banking. Today, know your borrower. You have no idea who your borrower is when you bought a derivative of a collateralized debt obligation.
Well, what did he suggest to solve this problem?
Well, he says, you know, the real problem is that innovation in financial services has moved faster and regulation just hasn't kept up with it, and he wants to regulate more. He wants to treat investment banks like regular banks, give them rules like requiring them to have cash reserves on hand. That's something regular banks have to do now. Investment banks don't. But he says if the federal government's going to be bailing them out, then they need to pay a little more of a price for that.
Congressman Frank has also been talking about plans to help cities buy foreclosed properties. What did he say?
He wants the federal government to come up with $10 billion to loan to cities and towns. And those cities and towns could take that money, buy up foreclosed property that's going unused, that banks are hanging on to, and turn that into affordable housing or, you know, other sort of developments to get that stuff back on the tax rolls and take care of neighborhood blight in some really hard-hit places.
Well, Congressman Frank was talking to some prominent pro-free market business leaders. What was the reception like?
Well, they were very sheepish, I guess I would say. Nobody got up and stormed out of the room because, you know, frankly, no one there really wants more government meddling in their business. They don't want more rules to follow, and they do feel like markets sort of sort things out. But they're sheepish because, you know, there are a lot of smart people who were surprised by what happened. And this week, as Frank told them, a dumb government ended up bailing out a smart company, Bear Stearns.
Here Now is business reporter Kurt Nickisch. Kurt, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
On this day 5 years ago, the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq was underway. Well, we're marking that anniversary today by catching up with two former guests. First, you may remember our past conversations with Army Sergeant Terry Blogg. He's a ballet dancer when he's stateside, and he still stretches using the back of his Humvee as a bar. He was part of the surge of troops into Iraq last year, his third tour of duty there. He and fellow soldiers are living in an abandoned shopping mall in the Mansour district of Baghdad, where Saddam Hussein supporters used to live. They're trying to establish the first new police station in Mansour since the war started. Well, a week ago Monday, five of Sergeant Blogg's men were killed by a suicide bomber as they patrolled the streets. It was the deadliest day for Americans in Baghdad in 6 months. Terry joins us on the line from Baghdad, and first of all, we are so sorry for your loss.
Thank you. It's good to hear from you again.
Well, what happened?
Well, the reports are pretty much accurate. One of the things that we're trying to do is to build up the local infrastructure and get businesses going, and sometimes things get through the gaps, and that's what happened in this case.
Yeah. You knew your guys were a target.
Oh, yes, constantly.
Do you feel that it was just an anomaly, or is the violence going up?
That's a good question. An anomaly, I would say no. An effort to have the violence go up, I would say yes.
Yeah. So how do you prepare for that? How do you counter that?
It's actually pretty simple. it just means a more aggressive security posture on our part. Reinforce the bubble that we call it, space bubble around us. Unfortunately, and this happened to us last time, every time we're out there trying to do good deeds, you know, and you relax your guard a little bit, a lot of times this is what occurs. You try and be the good guy and do the right thing, and somebody's going to take advantage of that. You know, it's hard. It really is, because, you know, you want to, one of the things we're trying to do is build up their local governments, and that's difficult to accomplish at a safe distance.
Right.
It's almost a catch-22 at that point.
And how are your guys that remain dealing with these deaths and the debate over whether or not troops should stay or troops should go? Does it become a debate there, or are they just focused on their mission?
Well, as far as the debate's concerned, naturally, you know, we all would rather be home. But, you know, the reality is here, you know, we're too far into this to pull out now. We all know that. I'm not one of the guys that lives here behind the walls. You know, I live out in the sector. Being safe, I don't know, my rifle and my guys next to me, that's what makes me feel safe.
Terry, thanks so much, as always.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Army Staff Sergeant Terry Blagg, a ballet dancer when he's stateside. He's currently posted in the Mansour district of Baghdad, establishing a police station. Five of his men were killed by a suicide bomber a week ago Monday. Well, there has been progress in Iraq. Violence is down. Some political progress has been made. But for one view from Iraq, we bring in Huda Ahmed. She's an Iraqi journalist who worked for the McClatchy newspaper chain in Iraq. She was one of thousands of Iraqis who put their lives at risk by working with Americans. This year, she's a visiting scholar at Stanford University. But you might remember that when she first fled Iraq for the States in 2006, she was our intern here at Here and Now while studying at MIT here in Boston. And she's in constant email contact with home. So, Huda, you've talked to us about how before the war, Iraq was a mixed society, Shiites and Sunnis working, living together. You say the country has become segregated along sectarian lines now. Can you give us an example of that?
Let's go to the taxi driver. If the taxi driver is a Shia, he will take you as far as the end of the Shia street, no more than that. And if he's a Sunni, it's the same thing. Now we don't marry from each other. Many of love affairs that failed because of that. People are thinking far more about what to name their newborn babies. They started to use neutral names, different names that got nothing to do with Shia or Sunni because they are thinking ahead. Even relationships between neighbors have changed because of so much bloodbath that took place between them. So it will take really a long time to heal these wounds.
So this new segregated society doesn't bode well for, you know, shaping a country after troops leave. But there's talk of amnesty and reconciliation, you know, people getting homes back from people who took them. Do Iraqis think that that's possible?
Where did that happen? Just on the news, they talk about people going back to their homes. I've talked to many of them. They still are leaving their houses and live in rented houses. They go and rent a house in a different area. So this is the second or third year that we are talking about reconciliation, and reconciliation with whom? I mean, our politicians cannot reconciliate between each other. So how do they want the people to reconciliate?
What about the surge? I mean, the fact is, Huda, you know, we've had some terribly violent situations in the last couple of weeks, but overall, violence is way down. Don't Iraqis take heart from that?
No. Because they believe that the decline of the violence, the peace they had for a few months, is just temporary, and they are afraid of something horrible coming back. They are afraid of the other militias.
What about the awakening councils, these Sunni, formerly Sunni insurgents who are now fighting foreign fighters and members of al-Qaeda on the side of Americans?
That's true. And thanks to them. I mean, they are very brave people. But at the same time, those awakening groups are the same insurgents who fought Iraqis and fought the American troops. And now the American troops are helping them by paying them salaries every month. But once the American forces turn their back to these awakening groups, they will fight them again. Be sure that they're going to be loyal to the government or loyal to the country.
You know, Huda, we're talking about your homeland, Iraq, in terms that, you know, we read about it in the newspaper. You know, someone's going to target this group's going to target that group. Yes. You know, you have family there. What is their life like on a daily basis?
It is very boring, really boring and dull, and they like, there is nothing we do, there are no jobs, no work. Also, they try to live with the inflation that's going around in the country.
How bad is the inflation? Give me some equivalent prices.
For instance, cooking gas used to be in the past, let's say, like $1-$2. Now they are taking it for $10 or $15. Now many families cannot afford that. So what they do, they are using the oil lamps to cook their food or to heat water so they can wash up. Or they wash their clothes because we don't have electricity. I was talking with my sister, and she said, we have only 1 hour or 1 hour and a half during the day. So she's racing with my mother and with my sisters who goes to the shower first.
What do they do, Huda, during the day? You say it's so boring. I mean, do they read? Do they watch TV? What do they talk to their neighbors? What do?
They wake up very late in the morning, and then they try during the day to find a job. People would prefer to stay safe in their houses because they cannot tell or predict when an IED or a suicide bomber would come to this place and blow them up. So they try to communicate with their friends, trying to form like kind of small parties or meetings with each other so they can talk about trivial things that they forgot, because what they talk most of the time is about the prices, about the security, electricity, the gas, the oil.
You say that instead of concentrating on that, they try to talk about the trivial things they forgot, like what, little things about life that they don't want to forget, little things about daily life?
Yeah, they want to talk about who got engaged, what kind of makeups, what kind of fashions, dresses, about, you know, like girl stuff. So they want to, you know, try to find something to talk about, love, talk about jokes, gossips, whatever it is. They exchange, you know, jokes by emails, even love affairs are now on, you know, emails and on internet instead of meeting each other in person.
That's Iraqi Huda Ahmed, a journalist who worked for the American McClatchy newspapers in Iraq and is now a visiting scholar at Stanford University. But she keeps in constant email contact, as we're hearing, with her friends and family back home. When we come back, whatever could an Iraqi find to joke about in an email? We'll ask Huda. Also later in the show, how Iran could play a role in stabilizing her country. We'll have an argument for U.S. diplomatic relations with Iran. Back in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with more from Huda Ahmed, an Iraqi journalist who's currently a visiting scholar at Stanford, but she worked alongside us at Here and Now last year while she was studying at MIT. And Huda, we started our conversation by talking about the sectarian divide in Iraq. You say that when people get into a taxi, the driver will only take them to the end of the driver's street, you know, for fear of militias from different sects. And before the break, you mentioned how Iraqis are using humor to deal with things like this. You've pulled up a joke for us that illustrates that, and also the deep split again. So just try us.
Okay, one of the jokes that says that one man died and his spirit left him.
His spirit?
Yes, to go to heaven, but instead came back. So he asked his spirit, why did you come back? His spirit said, are you stupid? The southern militia are in the beginning of the street. Do you want me to go there? No way. So she came back to him again. So this is kind of they joke about that.
Would you rather be there?
In Iraq?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I cry every night that I'm not able to see them. I cry every time that I call them on the phone And my sisters tell me about my nephews or my nieces, how they are growing up, or what they doing in school, how well they are doing. A newborn baby, who's sick and who's not, and I have to be worried about them. I missed being there in person, and I miss my job. I miss my work there. It's not what I expected. I thought that being in a democratic, liberated, unified Iraq, that I could write whatever I want, even criticizing whoever, the militia or the insurgents or the officials in the government, no matter what, because, I mean, it's supposed to be that we have free expression, free press, and not be prosecuted or assassinated and or kidnapped and then tortured, and that our families have to suffer to see this scene. It is so frustrating, so scary, so sad. It's like we got rid of one Saddam, now we have more than one Saddam. Those officials that they made pink, rosy dreams for Iraqis, they've been talking about that for 5 years. They didn't accomplish anything. I wanted to write about corruption. I wanted to write so much, to go back and write about women's rights, about children, how war affected them, what kind of generation we going to have, that they are leaving schools, they cannot go to schools. Even if they are going, they are not getting the right, you know, education. I really miss my old life. I thought I'm going to be, you know, a hello reporter there, that I'm going to write everything, I can talk about everything, and I don't have to worry about being threatened or being tortured or killed. And I don't want to imagine that picture, how I'm going to look like if I get haunted. So it's the image of every journalist and every Iraqi, not every journalist, but also every Iraqi live there. I mean, going out from home, and then they end up blowing up or being kidnapped and mutilated. So I don't know if those insurgents who or militias consider themselves Muslims, how can you mutilate a body? How can you kidnap and kill innocent people? I mean, is it enough for Iraqis what they've been through? When will they have this life that the Iraqi government been talking about? 10 years? 20 years? Who's going to live until then? People want something on the ground. The Iraqi government been talking about spending $68 billion for 2007. Where is that? If you go around and go to Iraqi hospitals, they're the same old hospitals. Do we have to thank Saddam Hussein for them, for being there? I mean, the schools are the same old schools. The ministries that been damaged during the war 2003, they are the same. They are standing there. So what kind of infrastructure they are talking about? Those people who got blown up, who were injured, they're going to die because there are no proper medical services. Nothing.
Huda Ahmed, so it's safe to say that you are profoundly disappointed.
Yes, I am. And the evidence for that, look, what happened on March 17th? Do you see any kind of celebration? Did you see any sign of happiness? Any joy? Nothing. We don't want to talk about the mistakes. We want to look forward for the future.
And Huda, it sounds as if for people who are pointing fingers at Iraqis and saying, well, it was Iraqi forces and politicians that didn't step up to the plate. You know, the troops aren't getting trained. The politicians aren't coming up to political solutions. You're saying that that's blaming the Iraqis too much for the lack of progress in the fifth anniversary?
Yes. I mean, that's what the officials are doing. They are trying to find any excuse, trying to find anything to put the blame that the Iraqis are impatient. How much patience you want?
Do you see any sliver of hope, Huda?
I have to. We have to. This is a fact. No matter what, we have to clinch to a hope, even if it was a little hope.
Huda Ahmed, an Iraqi journalist who is currently a visiting scholar at Stanford University. Huda, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
And again, Huda is our former intern here on Here and Now. When we first spoke to her from Northern California, we teased her and asked her if she was going to become a hippie. She said, no, I can't be a hippie. I'm an Iraqi. We'll have to memo, tell Huda what a hippie is. Later today, searching for faith in a troubled world, we'll meet an American woman who went from pew to pew looking for a community. Back after the news, Here and Now. While visiting the Middle East this week, Republican presidential hopeful John McCain said this.
We continue to be concerned about Iranian taking al-Qaeda into Iran, training them and sending them back.
But that's not true. Al-Qaeda and Iran are enemies. The Bush administration has accused Iran of training Shiite extremists, possibly Iraqis, to fight in Iraq. McCain's traveling companion, Senator Joe Lieberman, whispered a correction in his ear.
The Iranians are training extremists, not al-Qaeda. Not al-Qaeda. I'm sorry.
Well, McCain's campaign said the senator misspoke. Democrats question his knowledge. Either way, our next guest says the truth is important in shaping U.S. policy. Journalist Stephen Kinzer says Iran's hatred of al-Qaeda is one reason the next American president should use diplomacy to make Iran an ally. Stephen wrote about Iran-U.S. relations in the Boston Globe and joined us in the studio to make his point that Iran could help the U.S. stabilize Iraq.
The prime minister of Iraq has already described Iran's role as very, very helpful. But it's not in Iran's interest now to help stabilize Iraq completely. The Iranians are afraid that if they do that, the United States will use a stable Iraq as a platform to attack them. Once we assure Iran through diplomacy that that's not going to happen, Iran is going to have a vested interest in stabilizing Iraq. Now, it wouldn't make sense for the United States to turn over responsibility for Iraqi security to Iran or to any other country. But Iran, along with other countries in that region, particularly Syria and Turkey, can play a great role and essentially be our ticket out of Iraq.
Well, but what if Iran then does begin to stabilize Iraq, but not in a way that the U.S. likes? What if the Sunnis are oppressed, the Kurds are oppressed?
That's why it's important to have other countries in the region involved also. Bear in mind also that Iran is a multicultural society. The Persians are the majority there, but there's a large Azeri community. There's a long history of Christian and Jewish cultures. I think that it's very much in Iran's interest to see a stable Iraq in which all factions play a role. And in fact, if you look back at the National Intelligence Estimate, there's one conclusion in there that I actually found even more interesting than the one that got all the publicity, which was the one that said Iran was not working on a nuclear weapons program. In that National Intelligence Estimate, our intelligence agencies concluded that Iran is a rational actor. It does not act on emotions. It sees its strategic benefit. What I would like to see is for the United States to behave that way also.
Well, in addition to wanting a stabilized Iraq, you're right, one of the other things that Iran and the U.S. have very much in common is that Iran is no friend of al-Qaeda's.
Actually, Iran was the enemy of al-Qaeda and the Taliban long before the United States was. You know, there was a famous episode in Afghanistan right after the Taliban took over when all the Western countries and every other country in the world withdrew all its diplomats from Afghanistan except Iran. Iran kept a consulate in the northern city of Mazar-i-Sharif. As soon as the Taliban forces took over Mazar-e-Sharif, their first action was to go to the Iranian consulate, pull out all the diplomats, and execute them. This was at a time when the United States still thought of the Taliban as a positive force. We were starting to negotiate with the Taliban for oil pipelines and other strategic ideas that we had. So the Iranians fully realize those movements as their bitter enemies and can help us isolate and crush them.
What does the U.S. do about human rights violations in Iran? We just saw an election where democratic movements were repressed and reformists banned. Can the U.S. just sort of look the other way?
Absolutely not. I'd like to see the human rights aspect figure prominently in these negotiations, and the model that I think we might look to is the Helsinki Accords of the 1970s. Bear in mind that there were very strong human rights components in those accords, and those human rights components led to the emergence of forces inside the Soviet Union and inside the countries of Eastern Europe that played a very important role in ultimately bringing the democracy that those countries now are striving to achieve.
You also point out that there are already sort of hands reaching out from Iran that many Americans aren't as aware of, that the Iranian people are very pro-American people. Not their leadership now, but the Iranian people. And Iranians also, you know, have deep, fond feelings, admiration for Jews.
It's quite remarkable that despite all the troubles that have afflicted U.S.-Iranian relations, Iran is the only country in the Muslim Middle East where most people are pro-American. This is a huge strategic asset for us. And you're absolutely right that there is a long history of cooperation between Persian and Jewish people in the Middle East. This goes back to King Cyrus, who liberated the Jews from the Babylonian captivity 25 centuries ago. There is the basis, despite what you're hearing from provocative leaders in Tehran, for a new power arrangement in the Middle East that could include not just the U.S. and Iran, but possibly Israel, possibly Turkey. Now, maybe these negotiations couldn't work. Maybe they would fail. But this option is so low cost. We really need to give it a try, particularly since we have had repeated feelers from Iran that suggest to us that people in very high places in Tehran would love to pursue these kinds of negotiations.
Oil might play an interesting role in all of this. One Americans might not guess at. Iran might need the U.S.?
Iran, of course, is sitting atop an ocean of oil, yet the Iranian oil industry is in a terribly broken down shape. It hasn't had any investment for 30 years. There isn't even a single oil refinery in Iran. Iran has to send its oil abroad and then buy it back. Iran's oil industry needs 20, 30, $50 billion worth of investment. The United States is perfectly placed with the know-how and the capital to provide that. This could be a wonderful bridge for not just a political, but an economic opening between these two countries.
So, Stephen Kinzer, Samantha Power, a former advisor to Barack Obama, voices being raised to, you know, encourage the United States to open talks with Iran. Do you think any presidential candidate is going to start talking about that anytime soon?
It's hard to imagine a candidate is going to come out very strongly right now and insist on negotiations. Nonetheless, I don't know when we got to the point when we started to consider negotiating with countries you don't like as something that you do out of weakness. The United States should have more self-confidence than this. You don't need to negotiate with your friends. It's precisely the countries that behave in ways you don't like that you must engage. The more concerned you are about the developing Iranian nuclear program, the more outraged you are at the suppression of human rights in Iran, the more you worry about Iranian support for militant groups like Hezbollah and Hamas, the more urgent the negotiating track becomes.
Stephen Kinzer, former New York Times correspondent, author of All the Shah's Men, An American Coup and the Roots of Middle East Terror. Stephen, thanks as always.
Always a pleasure.
Okay, one quick note on an upcoming story. Next week, NPR's Scott Simon will be here with his new novel about Chicago politics. You're listening to Here and Now. In the world of synchronized swimming, the multiple medal-winning Aquamaids of Santa Clara, California are legendary. But the Aquamaids are also notable because one of the swimmers is, well, an Aquaman. 18-year-old Kenyon Smith is the only guy on this team of young women and a phenomenon in the sport. But he can't compete in the Olympics or in events that lead up to the Olympics. We want to find out why. Kenyon Smith joins us on the line. Kenyon, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And you can't compete in the Olympics because?
Because I'm a man.
Just because you're a guy.
Yeah.
Well, let's find out more about that because your coach, Chris Carver, is with us as well. Chris, welcome to you.
Hello. How are you?
I'm fine. What is the thinking? Why can't men synchronize swim in the Olympics?
Well, because the name of the event is Women's Synchronized Swimming.
Well, there's that.
Just as women's rhythmic gymnastics.
Well, but is there any thinking of expanding it? I mean, in the Summer Games, women are excluded from boxing and baseball, men excluded from softball and rhythmic gymnastics. But is there, you know, any sense that, especially because of Kenyon's performances, that this might be opened up?
Well, it's our hope that eventually it will be opened up because there is a mixed pair event, and it's a natural event, just as figure skating has mixed pairs.
Well, and, you know, Coach Chris, you know, a lot of people have an image that we're going to discuss of synchronized swimming. It's the Saturday Night Live skit. It's just, you know, they think of it as, you know, women kind of, you know, lazily swimming backwards in a pool. You know, synchronized swimming now has become a turbo sport like cheerleading has changed over the years. Describe some of the skills that Kenyon displays in the pool.
Well, you're absolutely correct about the way the sport has changed and grown and the demands on it. And when you think about a program that lasts 3.5 to 4 minutes, half of which is underwater, while you're doing very, very difficult gymnastic movements, both upside down and right side up.
Now, Kenyon, I did dabble in synchronized swimming a long time ago. It was horrible. I actually attribute my current sinus problems to synchronized swimming. It is so hard, so much harder than you think. Can you describe one of the moves, one of the more difficult moves, and what it feels like for you?
Well, doing a long figure upside down, holding your breath, the end of a routine is very difficult. You start to feel the lactic acid build up, and you're exhausted, and you're counting and focusing on making sure you're in pattern with your other teammates, and it's just very difficult.
But Kenyon, I'm wondering, do you get teased by people? We see pictures of you standing in the Aquamaid photos, and there you are with your very glitzy matching Speedo.
I used to get teased a lot, but things have changed. Everyone I swim with has respect for me, and I love swimming with them, and they love swimming with me, so no, not really anymore.
Well, let's address, both of you, what may be the underlying problem here. As we said, a lot of people, when they think of synchronized swimming, they only think of that iconic send-up from Harry Shearer and Martin Short in nose plugs. I believe Martin Short also wore a life preserver while doing their male synchronized swimming.
It's not going to be easy. My brother and I know it's not going to be easy. Men have never done synchronized swimming.
I don't swim.
So funny, but do you think that set your goals back?
Well, I think it didn't really set us back, but it just continued to give the same image of what synchro is.
Switching your head left and right.
Coach
Chris, I mean, you've seen them.
I loved it. I say, you know, in a low-profile sport, I'm just glad they noticed us. And, of course, at that time, you know, we were new in the Olympic Games, and there's an element of truth to it. An element, the kind of the girly part of it, which is kind of why I like men in it, because it kind of eliminates all of that. It's truly, truly a sport, and I think that men, the level of Kenyon, and when you talk about teasing, you see it, you couldn't possibly tease him.
So Kenyon Smith, remember when you swim, you're swimming for Martin Short and Harry Shearer because they couldn't. I want to thank you both.
You're very welcome, Robin.
Thank you.
Kenyon Smith, a member of the Aquamaid synchronized swimming team in Santa Clara, California. His coach, Chris Carver, 3-time head coach of the U.S. Olympic synchronized swimming team. Back in 1 minute, here and now. And now we want to air some of your thoughts because we received a lot after yesterday's segment on the impact of Barack Obama's speech on race and religion. Susan Hayden of Philadelphia thought the speech moving and necessary, but added, "It's distressing that when Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell, who's white, made an honest comment that some whites in Pennsylvania aren't ready to vote for a black person, he was roundly castigated." Deanna Herrera-Thomas from Bayside, California writes, "It was refreshing to hear a speech from a politician that took for granted that American voters from all races can digest information without being patronized." Karen France of Wilmington, Delaware wrote us, "I'm sure Barack Obama is not the first person who has listened to a minister with opinions that do not match his own. I know I have." But Amy Daner of Sudbury, Massachusetts disagreed. "You can choose your friends, but not your family," she writes. "Obama could not choose who his grandmother was, but could easily have chosen a new pastor." To which Martha Catt in Charlotte, North Carolina replied, "How can he expect to change anything if all he ever does is walk away from people?" Madeline Zeisel of Newtown, Pennsylvania thought our coverage too negative. She writes, "If you can find any candidate ever who delivered such an honest, human, fair-minded address on such fraught issues, I am to be amazed and educated." And Brian Walker gives us our closing thought. He says, "Being black myself and from the south side of Chicago, these were words that the black community needed. They will very quietly move the discourse forward, opening the hearts to the greater nation of a people prone towards bitterness." Let the dialogue continue. Sunday is Easter. Millions of Americans will be going to church. And according to a recent Pew survey, more than a quarter of them will not go to the same church their parents did. How do you switch like that? Well, Ruth Laker, a licensed psychologist and mother of three from Kimberton, Pennsylvania, decided to find out. She visited 26 churches and synagogues in 12 months, staying inside the Judeo-Christian experience to try to find spiritual fulfillment and good parking. She actually carried a checklist of needs that included parking as she traveled from a conservative synagogue, where she stumbled into one Alan Epstein's bar mitzvah, to an Assembly of God church in western New York, where she raised her hands to the heavens.
"Some people only lift one arm. I decide to try it out. It looks very inviting. I try the one arm first, very awkwardly and self-consciously, I'm sure. Something doesn't feel right. I try lifting both arms up. Yes, yes, this is much better. Of course, you are a little exposed and vulnerable in the posture, and you certainly want to be sure you've used your speed stick, but it feels much more balanced doing it with two hands. When you only have the one hand up, it's like you're only getting partial reception."
Ruth Laker tells of her adventures in her new self-published book, How to Choose a Church or Synagogue, a 21-pew adventure, and she joins us now from the studios of WRTI in Philadelphia. Ruth, welcome.
Thanks, Robin. Nice to be here.
This is a sacred space for many people. Are you making fun of people in these churches or honestly trying to fit in?
I went on this quest truly to try to find a place where I could belong and get more deeply involved than I ever have in a church.
What were you raised?
I was raised Presbyterian, so I would just kind of robotically go to the Presbyterian church, and I realized that this was, you know, not a great way to choose a place to worship, that I wanted to find out more about all the different places out there. So yes, this was a serious search for a church.
Well, serious, but there's humor and humanity. You're fascinated with the teachings of the Christian Science Church you visit, but you found the members a little reserved for you. But then you sit down and talk for hours with a rabbi who tells you, "Yeah, we talk to God, just like Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof."
Right.
And you were so moved at this one church that you had tears in your eyes, as did the pastor that you spoke to there. What happened at that Lutheran church?
Well, I had heard her speaking from the pulpit about how she liked Luke because Luke talked about women and the poor, and my ears immediately perked up. So I went to meet with her and talk with her about that, and she seemed uncomfortable about the fact that I wanted to explore women's issues with her more, and she told me that the Spirit really wouldn't support her talking about women's issues in the pulpit. And I was so surprised, and I said, "The Spirit wouldn't support it or the congregation wouldn't support it?" And she said, "Well, probably both." I left very discouraged, and then I don't know what made me go back to the church, but I did, and she started to launch into this sermon that was just an amazing, challenging sermon to the congregation about women's issues. Apparently, two other women had come to her during the same week that I did, and It was a very moving sermon. So at the end of the sermon, I went back to her, and she saw me and smiled, and I gave her a hug. And I said, you know, I really wasn't going to come back here because you said that the Spirit wouldn't support you talking about women's issues. And she said to me, well, Ruth, you were the Spirit. And I took that to mean you continue to talk about these things because they are important.
And she'll do as a pastor what she feels she needs to do for her congregation.
Right.
So you're passing these other pilgrims on the way, you know, as you go from church to church, a Quaker meeting house. Oh, so very quiet. You're right. Church of the Nazarene, Episcopalian. A lot of people would die to open a church door and just peek in. What were some of the things you saw that you'd just never heard of?
One of the things that really stuck with me was this experience of these new mega, you know, the mega super churches.
Mm-hmm.
I did go to two or three of those in my search, and I was very much surprised at the way those services are run, and it's very tightly produced and slick. You almost feel like you're in a television studio on the set of a TV show. And I found there was a loss of a sense of community there, which was one of the things that I was looking for. So it was a little surprising. That was very surprising to me.
What were some of the other interesting cultural things? Because for me, it was so interesting to read. It's not even as much about the theology, but just about how it's practiced.
There were just a lot of wonderful moments where I was meeting people who are genuinely very loving, and I just got this sense that a lot of people who go to churches want to do good. They want to have some place to take this sort of surplus energy they have that they want to direct toward helping others. And it was very moving in a lot of places to walk into a room with complete strangers and to really feel a sense of love and acceptance. And I felt that in a lot of the places where I went.
When you first walked into a Methodist Bible study, you walked in on the line. And that, to me, really captures Galatians like nothing else. Comments?
Right.
That was in that
right.
meeting. In a Mennonite meeting, you said like you felt like you were being held in a womb, and you also heard during the shout-out kind of prayers, somebody pray for someone else to get over their constipation.
Right.
And just these lovely, and like I said, more about the humanity. And yet you also wrote, you didn't see as many people as I think you would have liked smiling in the Catholic churches you visited.
Right. Well, you know, I went to a lot of Catholic churches because I've been married to two men who are both would call themselves recovering Catholics. So I went to five different churches because I wanted to really give it a fair shake. And I didn't see a lot of people smiling, and I was surprised about that.
Well, you don't want to tell us what you finally chose because you don't want to influence other people's thinking in either reading the book or making their own choices. But did you get the things you wanted?
I would say I did. I've joined a church, and it's been a really wonderful place. I've made a lot of great friends in the past year, and, you know, we've been together through a lot of situations just in this 1 year so far that have been pretty amazing. You know, we've had a person was murdered in our congregation, and we had a young woman who was killed in a car accident, a young woman recently, and people have all rallied together around those much more catastrophic kinds of things, and we're there for each other for just rides to the doctor or bringing a casserole to someone's house when they're not feeling well. So I'm really enjoying the community part of it, which was a big reason that I went on this search to find a community where I could really feel like I could belong.
Ruth Laker, author of How to Choose a Church or Synagogue, a 21-pew adventure. And full disclosure here, I found out about you. It's a self-published book, and my sister had one. And so that's how I found out about Ruth doing this all without, you know, a big publishing house behind you. To find out more, go to our website, here-now.org. Ruth, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.